We're going to be doing looking at something which in theology you call eschatology. Eschaton is just Greek for the end. So eschatology is the study of the end. So the end of the world, that kind of stuff. Apparently a whole bunch of, I don't know if this is true or not, because you never quite know how true things are on social media, but apparently a whole bunch of people in America were thinking because of an eclipse of the sun yesterday, it's going to be the end of the world. Turned out it wasn't the end of the world, so, you know.
It was in America.
So the end of the world, it can be, this kind of, that kind of eschatology can have its paranoid versions. But every Christian believes that Jesus is coming back. That's an eschatological belief. But what's interesting is, in a way, wrestling with this theme we're doing this semester of climate crisis is kind of dealing with a this-worldly eschatology too, isn't it? It's like a drastic end to the way we're used to things being. For some people, it really is like an apocalyptic end-of-the-world disaster. It will be extinction, you know, and so it's seen with that great seriousness. But for everybody, at the very least, it's the end for the way things have been to some extent or another, you know. So it's wrestling with a similar question. How do you live in the light of, whether it's literally the end of this whole age and universe and Jesus coming back and Judgment Day and the dawn of eternal life and eternal judgment, that kind of horizon, or just the smaller horizon of how do you live in the light of around the corner things being drastically different to the way they are now? Now, it's not surprising in history that often when things are drastically changing in the world, it's kind of not surprising people will start to think the end with a capital E is nigh, is it? You know, like if you're living through the Black Plague and like a third of the population is being wiped out, then to think, oh, maybe this is the end, you can see why people would begin to think those kinds of things, right? So we're wrestling that question of eschatology, but it intersects with ethics, because the question this morning, living well at the end of the world, is what does it mean to be a good person when you're on the Titanic and it's sinking? What does it mean to be a good person when all the normal order of things seems to be melting away around you? What would it mean to live well if the end is nigh? Yeah, so it's kind of eschatological ethics, end-time morality. How do we fit those two things together? And I think because Christianity does speak right back into the first century, as we just read, about that kind of question, thinking about Jesus coming back, it does give us some resources to then think about, well, what do you do if there's an impending national disaster, ecological disaster, epidemic disaster? You'll be pulling some of the similar threads. You'll be saying, well, how should I conduct myself if I believe the way things are won't always be this way, and that the way things are will get worse, and that there are time pressures on the way things are. Yeah? Christianity has wrestled with that and has this over a long period of time. So we'll be thinking about that this morning. A couple of the conclusions that people reach that are wrong, we'll touch on some others in a second, but a couple of really obvious ones that you might have thought of or heard, is on the Christian side, there's a certain branch of Christianity that can very flippantly say, ah, who cares about the environment, the oceans, the whales, the fungus, the parrots, the whatever it is, because it's all going to burn up anyway, right? Jesus is coming back soon, so who cares? So that's one I want to show you wrong attitude, to say because Jesus is coming back, therefore this world doesn't matter, and what we do in this world in terms of care for it doesn't matter. So that's one wrong religious view, a sub-Christian view. Another kind of view that you hear in a more secular world is an especially despairing attitude, particularly to having kids. It's immoral to bring a child into a world like the world we're going to live in the 21st century. How could you want to? That kind of question. And it's quite a despairing question, I think. It's saying we are certain that the future is so much worse than it is good. Now, people sometimes tie that to worries about overpopulation. Although it must be said, in a country like ours, the issue is underpopulation and aging population, that actually the question of whether UTAS graduates have two or three or four kids instead of none or one is not going to make or break the global population. If anything, it's actually going to provide a more stable population for aged care and the ongoing sort of life of society. So that's kind of a little bit of a precious thing, I think, when first world people, for other reasons, cultural, economic, social, make decisions about kids, claiming that's a overpopulation issue. But the deeper reason for it is this eschatological one. The end of the world is near, so you should stop having kids. Like we read here, those who have wives should live as if they have none. We could say, well, those who have husbands and wives should live as if they're not, those who are fertile should live as if they're not, you could add, something like that. Yeah. So there are a couple of examples of where people go, the world is so hopeless, I do not wish for human life to continue in it, it's so disastrous. Here's another version of that. So that's what we're going to wrestle with this morning. What does it mean to live well in the light of drastic change, even negative, disastrous change? How does it live to live rightly if there are urgent things that need to be done, or very, very, very important things that need to be done, you know? Well, let's first of all think of some false avenues, okay? I'll be mainly talking about living in the light of Jesus coming back. But again, as I say, a lot of this stuff maps across to living in the light of the climate crisis. So our first one is to adopt what some people call a crisis ethics, to say actually the rules of morality totally change in crisis. That's a way people interpret this little passage here and a lot of the weird parables of Jesus that are really full on. You know how Jesus will say, like, gouge out your eye, cut off your hand, hate your father and mother, that kind of stuff, let the dead bury their own dead. They say, oh, that's because the early Christians thought that Jesus was literally coming back in a decade or so, or a couple of decades, and so it was just like a completely different rules apply. You know, if there's a fire in your house, don't go and rescue every single bit of memorabilia and teddy and photo and whatever it is. You've got to get out of the house. You know, if the plane's crashing, don't, you know, leave your luggage and get off the plane, so on and so forth. That's the kind of argument. People think that to cope with these hard sayings in the Bible, here's a quote from one character, the end of all civilization and its values is the way one ethicist describes this view, that demand, quote, mighty acts, sometimes superhuman acts, things that would be simply impossible under ordinary circumstances. So that's some ethicists describing this kind of attitude. It often is connected with this view that people thought, whenever you read the time is short, the night is nearly over, Jesus is coming soon, that this is a chronological estimate, that literally the first century Christians said, oh, it's a few years, a few months, a decade, but that's the kind of the view. That reconstruction of the first century, I want to suggest to you, is like a speculative overread. It's missing the difference between what you could say is a theological view of the time we're in, as opposed to a chronological estimate of the time we're in. So a theological view of the time you're in is to say, Jesus has died, Jesus is risen, the next thing that will happen in God's timetable is Jesus will come back. So that's a theological view of time, to say, whether it's a day or 1,000 years, whether it's a few months or a few centuries, the era we're in is the era where Jesus is coming back. Do you see what I mean? So it's not so much a chronological estimate as a characterization of the time we're in. Yeah, that's quite different to saying, oh, it's a couple of months, a couple of years. A bit like, you know, when you're looking for a job, that might take a couple of days. It may, in worse situations, take a couple of years, but either way, you're still in the zone of looking for a job. Do you know what I mean? And you can't just say, oh, I'm looking for a job right now, therefore I can't come to the movies tomorrow night because, you know, I could be starting my job. It's like, well, no, man, like it could be a couple of days or a couple of weeks or a couple of years. So, you know, let's come to the movies, you know, so that kind of thing. It's here one person who's written on 1 Corinthians said, we can't confuse a theological stance of imminence of God, Jesus' return, with a chronological estimate of imminence. The time we live in is the time where there's nothing that stands between the events surrounding Jesus' return, and our whole outlook and orientation is waiting for Jesus' return, whether that is a day or millennia. Like you probably know that bit from Peter's second letter, later on in the Bible, where he says, for the Lord a day is like 1,000 years, 1,000 years is like a day, So when people say, oh, where's Jesus? I thought he was meant to be coming back. You know, where's this coming he promised? It's like, oh, no, you don't understand that Jesus will come back, but that doesn't mean it's, you know, necessarily next week or on April the 8th with a full solar eclipse. Even if Jesus were to return in a matter of months, actually, I'm not convinced that this calls for crisis ethics. If Jesus is coming back in a couple of weeks, should I not care for my family? Am I free to steal and loot and plunder as a Christian if Jesus is coming back next week? Although my priorities will shift, of course, the underlying realities of good and evil don't change. And you know what? A lot of the really thoughtful apocalyptic movies and books get that. Most recent one, perhaps, in keeping with climate crisis stuff, in a way, is that Don't Look Up film. People seen that one? Don't Look Up. It's a good film. Where is this a spoiler? Well, it is. If you care, you can block your ears. It doesn't end well. But at the ending, you get a picture of one way to live in the light of it's not going to end well, which is like this. Sitting with people around a table, eating, laughing, talking, doing what's meaningful. Yeah? There's something wrestling with there about going, it's not like, oh, because the end is coming, therefore let's come and transform into these doomed, disastrous, pleasure-seeking. There's another older book you may not have heard. Have you heard of On the Beach by Neville Shute? Again, beautiful novel. It's about there has been already a nuclear war and it's slowly working its way south. We're in Melbourne. And so this is one of the last places on the planet that's actually reached the fallout, and it attracts people trying to figure out solutions, other kind of groups of people who've kept safe. And slowly as it dawns on 20th century Melbourne that actually the end is nigh, at first people do spill over into panic, looting, whatever. And then after a while, people go back to kind of learning history, learning typing, gardening, because in a sense, like that's what do you do? What are you meant to do? Like, there's a sense in which the reality is you still, those things are still valuable, meaningful, they matter, even if they're temporary. Yeah? And there's a reason why humans have that instinct, not merely because of biological imperative, that's part of it, but also because God has written that order into our hearts and minds and morality, that we go, you know what? Our relationships are meaningful, not merely because they have a full lifetime of legacy kind of use-by date on them. They're meaningful even if it's a day or two. A relationship and time well spent with someone who's got a very short prognosis. It's not like, well, why bother going to see Nan? She won't be here. It's the opposite, isn't it? We go, well, while Nan is here, being with Nan is important. Yeah? Good things remain good. A bit of a punk rock Christian ethicist, a guy named Stanley Hauerwas, puts it well, but he says, the difference between doomsday cults and healthy religion is that doomsday cults slip into crisis ethics. They forget about the goodness of this world. Yeah? And so therefore, if the end is coming, drink the poisoned Kool-Aid and die en masse. And I guess you get the extreme end of environmentalism is kind of a doomsday cult, isn't it? You know, you can break whatever social rules and drift into all sorts of extremely negative views of society and humanity because the end is nigh and is so desperately urgent. Any means is justified by the ends. So it's not moral crisis is the first take. A second take on this stuff is it's not Stoic philosophy. Have you heard of Stoic philosophy? It's one of the it's a funny one, old Greek philosophy. There were the Stoics and the Epicureans. I remember when I studied philosophy at uni, our history of philosophy lecturer said, in a funny kind of way, the Stoics ended up being much more pleasure-seeking and the Epicureans ended up being much less pleasure-seeking because the Stoics were saying, don't focus on the things you can't control, but actually go with the grain of the universe and you'll find a great deal of joy. Whereas the Epicureans said the key is to find pleasure, but the best pleasure is to be found in the most restrained kind of... So it's ironic how these words evolve over time. But Stoic philosophy is quite similar to Christianity. With an important difference. Listen to this. This is a Stoic philosopher, Epictetus, saying stuff that is really actually spookily similar to 1 Corinthians 7, the whole chapter. Epictetus says, in such an order of things like the present, it is a question, perhaps, if the cynic ought not to be free from distraction, wholly devoted to the service of God, not tied down by private duties of men, nor involved in relationships which he cannot violate and still maintain his role as a good and excellent man. Whereas on the other hand, if he observes them, he will destroy the messenger, the scout, the herald of the gods that he is. For see, he must show certain service to his father-in-law, to the rest of his wife's relatives, to his wife himself. Finally, he's driven from his profession as a philosopher to act as a nurse in his own family, to provide and care for them. It's quite similar in a way, isn't it? Like, those who have wives live as if they none, those who have buy things as if it's not theirs to keep. In fact, later on in 1 Corinthians, if you look at verse 32, Paul says, I would like you to be free from concern. An unmarried man is concerned about the Lord's affairs, how he can please the Lord, but a married man is concerned about the affairs of this world, how he can please his wife. His interests are divided. It's quite similar, hey? So there's a similarity there of high ideals, high discipline, restraining disordered desire. There's a lot of echoes between Christianity and Stoicism. That is true. A surface similarity, a genuine truth they even agree on when it comes to singleness, you could say. That there's a singleness of focus that a single man, and a lot of modern discourse points out, you know, single women as well, particularly in Jewish, right? There's a famous book that talks about how, you know, men need lives and women need wives, in the sense that the book was arguing when women get burdened with being wives and mothers and all that, they can't pursue other career opportunities as easily. There's great benefits that men, and especially women, enjoy in singleness. There's some observations of truth there to an extent. A single person might be able to give themselves with particular intensity to research, exploration, even alternative energy research. Yeah? And new habitat exploration, and new lobbying and political change and fundraising avenues in the light of the climate emergency, or new evangelistic efforts and new pioneering missionary works and so on. Sure, there are benefits to that kind of stuff. But while there is truth in this Stoic perspective, there is also a big difference between it and the Bible. The Bible actually gives a much higher view of worldly things themselves. The Bible emphasizes often that God made the world. He made other things than himself that are good goods that can be pursued in addition to worshiping God, and that are good to receive and enjoy. The Bible speaks about that a lot, doesn't it? Enjoy, give thanks, a feast, you know, all this kind of stuff. It's not a book of a stern, disciplined, narrow, or like to use the modern YouTuber Stoic kind of ripped and with really good kind of Bitcoin sort of investments, sort of discipline, sort of focus. No, there's something more overflowing, joyful, communal, celebratory in the Christian vision, because the whole world is valuable. It's good and right and holy and spiritual and philosophical to marry, to make love, to raise children, to feast, to plant, to reap, to pause, to celebrate, to buy, to sell, to build, to plant. When the Lord describes the single man or woman as concerned about the Lord's affairs in undivided devotion to the Lord, he's not denying that a married Christian also serves the Lord in their marriage. Yeah, that both are good avenues for serving and worshipping and honouring the Lord. Yeah. Furthermore, the dominant reason Paul gives for the sacrificial life in verses 29 to 31 is not a low value of marriage or a low value of emotions or a low value of property, but the time we are in. So whereas the Stoic says, don't do this because philosophers don't do it, it's like an absolute. What Paul says is, because of the time we're in, conduct yourselves differently, right? What I mean is this, the time is short, verse 29. From now on, those who are married should live as if they're not, those who mourn as if they were not, those who buy and sell. Because this present world, in its present form, is passing away. Verse 31. So it's not saying, like, the real people, the most serious people, don't engage in these things, but it's things change for a season that we're in. So the Stoic view is, in that sense, not quite right. We're living as if, in a temporary way, as we wait for eternity. The philosopher Charles Taylor says, the Stoic sage is willing to give up health, freedom, or life, because he sees it as genuinely of little value. The Christian martyr gives up health, freedom, or life, not because they're of no value. On the contrary, the action of sacrificial martyrdom would lose its sense for the Christian if it weren't that life, freedom, and health were of great value. When a Christian gives up things, it's because they're testifying to a future where those things will be restored. It's a gesture of hope rather than just discipline, or worse, despair. So there's various ways that we can wrestle these questions. I think often we end up with slightly different and more simplistic ones. We kind of go, as long as I feel it a bit, I'm doing the right thing. So Christians can go, as long as I feel a bit uncomfortable in my decisions, I must be sacrificing for Jesus. I think intense environmentalists can be the same. As long as I'm feeling a bit uncomfortable, I must be doing the right thing. Now that's good as far as it goes, I suppose. It's good to stretch yourself. But it's hardly a deep ethical approach to things. And it misses the fact that often it's quite enjoyable to do the right thing. You know, that actually you can get pleasure and joy, and you may not notice that you're sacrificing. So it's not a perfect measure. It also misses the fact that ideological 20-somethings often kind of quite like living pretty simple, sparse, simplistic lives and living off only ramen noodles and kind of living in share houses. And so although it feels like they're kind of sacrificing all for the end of the world, they're kind of more or less living a sharehouse lifestyle and often freeloading off others in society, like when they drop their laundry back to mum and dad to get done for them, where there's often, there's often sort of hidden hypocrisies in the hero missionary Christian or the hero ecological warrior in other ways. Often it's even just life partners, hero ecological husband, is freeloading off sacrificial wife at home who doesn't get any of the credit, and so on and so forth. So it hurts a bit. There's some sense to it. It's a little bit minimal. Others will draw on analogies. So Christians will often talk about, oh, it's like we're on a sinking ship. What would you do if you're on a sinking ship and you had the gospel lifeboat? How would you get the gospel lifeboat out to everybody on the ship? Go and door knock Lord Street today, just like you were on a lifeboat, that kind of analogy. And again, ecological movements have similar analogies. What would it be like if you discovered, you were Will Smith, and you discovered that some zombie cure or some solution to an apocalypse, what would you do? We draw on these kinds of analogies. We're like soldiers who are turning cruise ships into soldiers' transport ships. What would you do? Again, the analogies can be helpful. But it's just important to remember they are analogies. We're not in a war. We're not in a zombie apocalypse. We're not in a sinking ship. And so it's not quite the same. You know what I mean? Even with the climate crisis, we're in a long-range, global, complex, challenging situation where, in a sense, what would you do? Well, I mean, I guess Professor Matt King, who we had at the thing the other week, I'll be part of think tanks. Go to meetings, I'll write research papers, I'll build diplomatic relationships with colleagues, interdisciplinary, in a sense, even if you had the zombie virus cure, what would you do? Well, I guess you'd scan and check the virus, you'd organise it with distributors, you'd do some blind tests, you'd work out how to get it across borders, you'd manage supply lines. In practice, things are slow and steady. And so whether we're dealing with a climate crisis, it's on the one hand urgent. On the other hand, it's very hard to get urgent change, so you've got to work slowly and steadily at it. It's the same with evangelism. You could run out there today and go, the end is nigh, the end is nigh, the end is nigh, we're on a sinking ship! And it would feel really awesome, like, oh, I'm doing, look how bold I'm being for the gospel, but would it actually save anybody? Probably not. They'd just go, oh, there's that psycho shouting, the end is nigh. So there's that tension, right, where, these analogies, they don't quite map. In the end, you need steady, long-term, collaborative work, whether it's evangelism or saving the environment. Okay, so then what does it mean? Let's move across to that. I'll jump ahead a little bit in my notes and let's have a look at that. The key thing here is to notice that what the Apostle Paul says here is it is living as if. Notice that again. Have a look. Have a look at this section. What I mean, brothers and sisters, verse 29, is that time is short. From now on, those who are married should live as if they were not. Those who mourn, as if they did not. Those who are happy, as if they were not. Those who buy something, as if it were not theirs to keep. those who use the things of this world, as if not engrossed in them, for this world, in its present form, is passing away. What kind of behaviour does Paul have in mind in this passage? On first reading, it's pretty troubling, right? Those who have wives or husbands should live as if they do. Now, I've got a strong sense of duty to care for my wife as she does for me, as Christine does for her husband, as he does for her. And so to be told by my Bible, oh yeah, live as if you're not married to him, seems just like, kind of hurts my feelings a little bit. and it does cause a justified ethical glitch. It's like, well, wait, what? So, you know, it's like when you read those passages, you know, Jesus says, if you want to come after me, hate your father and mother. Now, I don't know what all your relationships with your parents are like. Some of you might go, yep, cool, tick, already. But most of you, I'm sure, go, oh, that doesn't it doesn't feel right, you know, for good reason. It's not. It's a rhetorical phrase that's not to be taken on surface value. It's a basic rule of reading in context, yeah? You read anything in context, and you realise something is said that clashes with the contextual logic of what is said elsewhere, like in the Bible, so much is said about honour your father and mother, lay down your life for your wife like Christ does for the church, or show great concern for somebody and they mourn, and when they grieve, to be sacrificially serving one another in love, and on and on and on and on. Yeah, it's right to glitch and go, something else must be meant, right? There is affection, there is tenderness, there is interdependent relationship. We mustn't say, to use the example of marriage, reduce it as a vehicle for children, housework, and sexual favours. So what does it mean? Yeah, if it's right to go, oh, hang on, that can't be like literally like, you know, you kind of woke up for breakfast and it's like, hello, Christian evangelist officer 35421. Oh, good morning, time to sustain yourself, Christian evangelist officer 4432B. It's not like you slip into some kind of Christian minion mode. What does it mean? Clearly God is not saying, cannot be saying when read in the context of even the writings of the Apostle Paul, much less all the scripture, that we should abandon our marriages. We're not going to that doomsday cult thinking that I've referred to before. Yeah. Even in this very passage, chapter 7, verses 3 to 5, we talk about husbands and wives showing concern for one another, including making love for one another, to one another, as this interlocking expression of the command to love your neighbour as yourself. If you're married to someone, part of how you love your neighbour as yourself is by making love to your husband or wife. Towards the end of the passage, he assumes that if you're married, you will be concerned about the affairs of this world, verse 33, how to please your wife. Yeah, a married woman will similarly, a bit later on, be concerned with the affairs of this world, how she can please her husband. Yeah, so even in this very chapter, he's not saying absolutely don't live this way. Yeah. Similarly, as the passage goes on, verse 30, those who mourn as if they didn't, those who are happy as if they weren't, he's not saying ignore all your emotions. Elsewhere, the Apostle Paul speaks actually with great, I guess what would we use today? We'd use the word vulnerability as the buzzword of the day. He speaks with great vulnerability about his distress, his anxiety, his longing, both for male and female relationships, his friends, fellow Christians. Yeah, he's an expressively emotional human, the Apostle Paul, my goodness. And especially actually in his letters to the Corinthians. Like it's almost as if the Corinthians was given witness to get a window into the Apostle's life and mind and heart. Yeah. So it's not that you should dump your husband or wife, bottle up all your emotions, give away all your property, and don't use anything as much as absolutely possible. That's not the point. The key is in that little phrase, as if. That's how it's translated in most English translations, as if. Those who have wives, it's not those who have wives leave them. It's those who have wives live as if they do not. It's not those who mourn, cheer up. It's those who mourn as if they did not. It's not those who buy things, give it all away. But it's those who buy things. Well, these last couple of examples kind of explain it, don't they? The final two examples in the series clarified. Those who buy something as if it were not theirs to keep, See that, how that unpacks the as if? It's not give it all away straight away. It's those who buy it as if it's not yours to keep, is the explain. Those who use this thing of this world as if not engrossed in them. Here, you see, it's not absolute abandonment of duties or joys associated with this world, like the Stoic, but it's a relative disengagement, a qualified stance towards them, knowing that they are, in their present form, temporary. There's no justification to neglect your family, suppress your emotions, fail to service your car. There's a motivation to hold such things loosely. Martin Luther from the 16th century described this as not sinking too deeply into the world, either with love and desire or suffering and boredom, but rather behave like guests on earth, using everything for a short time because of need. We're citizens of heaven, aliens and strangers in this world, and looking forward to a heavenly country. John Calvin from the 16th century similarly says, all things that are connected with the enjoyment of the present life are sacred gifts of God, but we pollute them when we abuse them. We always dream of continuing on in this world forever, for it's owing to this and those things which ought to be helps in passing through this world. They become a hindrance and hold us fast to this world. For the man who considers he's a stranger in the world uses the things of this world as if they were someone else's. Paul, therefore, directs us to sober and frugal use of things, such as may not impede or retard, that is, slow down our course, but may allow us always hastening forwards towards the goal. This living as if stance doesn't deny the goodness of the world, nor does it show a lack of concern for people and things in the world. It still treats them as if they are as what they are, with kindness and respect and delight. The kind of sacrifice we're dealing with here is a version of treating things. It's like sacrificing one good thing for another. If Jesus weren't coming back, there would be good things in family life at a whole other level. But since Jesus is coming back, I exchange that good thing for this living as if. It's still a good thing. I still delight in it. But the right way to delight in it is delight in it in the light of Jesus' return. It's swapping that kind of good delight to this. And similarly, I might have a good thing. And if I had it forever and ever, if I'm in the new heavens and the new earth when Jesus comes back and I have a car, let's say, who knows what the new creation will be like. Let's say you have an awesome car, the car you've always dreamed of having, with your sort of Instagram scroll and YouTube kind of spec, whatever the unboxing version of cars is for cars about. And let's say you can have that when Jesus comes back. You'll enjoy that with a degree of eternality and sublime perfection that you'll never get to. Well, you shouldn't enjoy a car in this life. So yeah, you sacrifice being a total car geek in this life. But that's not a hatred of good things. Yeah, it's a qualified disengagement from them. And I guess this is the thing I've been wanting to say to you. That's actually the best way to live. The best way to live your life is in reality. Yeah? It's a lesser way to live life, to be really have lots of fun in a fantasy world. If you could get in a bubble and you're off Ibiza and you've got this awesome like yacht and you know you're hot and you hang around with hot people and you have all the money you want and all the great cars you want, but you're cut off from a reality of death and suffering and war and ecological crisis and Jesus' return, you're actually living a worse life because it's a fake life. It's not real. And so that is, in its realness, is part of goodness. Truth is one of the qualities of true goodness. Yeah? True goodness. Truthful goodness, right? So even while it's going good, it's not good because it's fake. You see what I mean? How much more the fact that it won't last forever. There are cracks in that life that will crack through. First of all, with boredom, because what is fun on day one and maybe still fun on day 400 starts to get pretty hollow and depressing even on that same gorgeous yacht come day 800 or 1800 or 2900. You start to go, the cracks even appear because it's a pretty thin life. How much more when actually one of the people on the yacht and the coastal village where you live and flounce around gets some shocking news back from the doctor, yeah? Or a relationship breaks down. Or the water levels rise. And then suddenly, then you go, oh my goodness, I've put all of my chips on the table, betting on that life, and now that life is starting to crumble. What have I got? It's a particular kind of nightmare when you put all your investments in this world as if it weren't passing away, as if you were engrossed in it, as if being happy now is all there is, as if being married now is all there is. It's not actually a better life. It's a better life to face reality and all its imperfection, which includes now the climate issues, but also face reality in the light of Jesus' return. If it's true that there's a God and that Jesus is the Savior and is coming back, then it's the best life to live, including the best economic life, business life, emotional life, and married life to live. To live in the light of that end. To live as if these things aren't lasting forever. It's a better way to live your life. Better way to raise your kids. Better way to enjoy your property. Better way to... And that's what we can bring as we close. So this whole climate crisis issue, I think, as Christians, if we can get that stuff in our heads, then we bring both a willingness to face reality in all its severity and to change our lifestyles in the light of it. Christians should be able to be like the Stoic at their best, like the eco-warrior at their best, to go, yeah, sign me up for some degrees of austerity. Sign me up for lifestyle change. Again, Matt from the panel talked about eating less meat, you know, because of the ecological footprint that meat farming and so on has. Yep, sign me up for less cheeseburgers than I thought I was going to live in my lifetime. Fine. You know, sign me up for those things because I understand that there is a goodness in living well in the light of the times, right? So we should be able to be on board with that. How much more when it's fueled by hope for a better future? So it's not even just sign me up for it for now to do good in the world, but sign me up because I'm already living for a greater reality. That already my joys now are temporary pleasures pointing to a greater hope. So we should be able to bring that. I urge you to bring that to your lives and your citizenship. But yeah, it also means that's how you build your life now. You know, that's how you build a Christian life. Those of you, I mean, I think all of us here are Christians. Yeah, how you build a Christian life is build it up this way, this living as if. It's not neglecting the things of this world entirely, but it's also not being engrossed in them utterly either. But in this in-between space, that's the best way to live your life. I think we're out of time, so I'll close in prayer.